for Russia against NATO. Both opposed NATO expansion and accused the US of stoking instability in the region. The two sides also decried the military alliance's Cold War approach to international affairs. There was an announcement made by the Russian president regarding energy, which also appeared to be a slap in the face of Europe when it came to their dependency on Russian gas. Putin announced a new deal to supply China with 10 billion cubic meters of natural gas from its Far East region, the largest such transit of gas in the world. But when it comes to energy, there is one obvious supplier that Europe can look towards, and that is Iran. If Europe wants to show good faith, especially in the Vienna talks, it can do that by having Iran provided with its energy needs. Iran has the second largest natural gas reserves in the world, holding more than 17% of global discovered gas fields. That does it for this section of the program. We look forward to getting your messages.
The U.S. is dead set to push Russia into a corner. But why? European countries are realizing that may not be in their best interest, like France and Germany, who don't want a war in their own backyard. Even the EU has realized this, which may explain why EU and France have called for a European army to not be subservient to NATO. But the U.S. has literally shot itself in the foot. Russia and China have aligned themselves against the U.S., while European countries may not be so keen to follow in the U.S. lead. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. I've been Omid Roshanda, filling in for Kaveh. Please write to us and let us know how we're doing. But before I say goodbye, a word for the Europeans, in case you forgot. Iran has a lot of gas. Oil, too.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. such a busy bazaar, as if all the people are here. You might ask yourself why I have come to this bazaar. Indeed, I am here to buy some souvenirs for my friends. Tonight, I'm going to take a trip to Yazd to visit my friends there. Also, the day after, I have planned to visit the ancient village of Kharonagh. Kharonagh village dates back to 4,500 years ago and is surely a spectacular place to visit. The historical village of Kharonagh is located in Yazd province, 70 kilometers to Ardekan County. In this region, there are iron ore, zinc, and granite mines. There is also a protected area in this region which is home to animals like wild goat, goat, sheep, mufflon, wildcat, caracal, and cheetah. Kharonagh, which used to be called Khuronagh in the past, means the place where the sun rises or the place where the sun is born. Kharonagh village has placed one of the large adobe structures of Iran in itself. This village has two parts. The new part in which over 500 people live and the old part or the castle of Kharonagh, which is damaged and empty. Some of the must-see landmarks of this village include Kharonagh Castle, the historical bath of Kharonagh, Kharonagh Caravansaray, Kharonagh Mosque and Hosseiniye, as well as the shaking minaret of Kharonagh. I am now in Kharonagh village. This village is ancient, and I'm so excited to see it. Kharonagh village dates back to the Sassanid era. This village used to be a place for taking rest by merchants and travelers. Let's look around the village together. I am now at Kharonagh Castle. This castle dates back to the Sassanid era. Well, this castle is surrounded by deep moats. These moats were used as a way to protect the residents of the castle against enemy forces. Six guard towers are attached to the body of the castle. There are 80 houses in this castle. In most villages of the Yazd city, you see nothing but adobe and mud. Oh, I'm so thirsty. My flask has run out of water. What a scent! The smell of wet earth is very pleasant. I'm crazy about this scent. Kharonagh village, like the city of Isfahan, has a structure called Shaking Minaret or Minar Jomban, which shakes. This minaret also dates back to the Sassanid era. Its height is 15 meters. The shaking minaret of Kharonagh used to have three floors. Its top floor used for watching and lighting. It used to have a wooden structure on its top, which had been tilted because of earthquakes and wind blow. So the locals of Kharonagh had detached it and brought it down. To be honest, I don't dare to get close to it. I am now at the center of Kharonagh Castle. Here, there is the Kharonagh Jame Mosque. This mosque dates back to the 8th to 10th century AH. Adobe and mud are the main materials used for building this mosque. Though, as it shows, bricks are also used in the minarets and facade of the mosque. It's very beautiful and spectacular. Actually, Kharonagh has many must-see places to visit, and unfortunately, I can't describe them all for you. Just tell you one thing. Don't miss the night sky of this region if you happen to visit here. The stars in this region are so near to you that you feel you can touch them all with your hands. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
As the Saudi war in Yemen rages on, clashes and cross-border strikes have escalated in the past few weeks. The Yemeni army has conducted several strikes on targets deep inside the United Arab Emirates in response to what it calls the Sheikhdom's complicity in the crimes committed against the people of Yemen. Sana'a has promised to continue the cross-border strikes until the blockade on Yemen is lifted and the war on the country is ended. But how is the UAE involved in the war? The country has been supporting the so-called Southern Transitional Council separatists in southern Yemen since at least 2018. Those are the mercenaries that took control of Yemen's resource-rich Socotra Island in 2020. This move was a departure from its coalition partner, Saudi Arabia, who is only interested in keeping the Yemeni army away from its border. But the UAE has shown interest in controlling the port of Aden as well. Its focus is to have control over the important waterway, the Bab al-Mandab, an important oil shipping route.
Clearly, that's exactly the intention and the reason that Israel and is involved is partly because that also means that they have at least the approval, the tacit approval of the United States as well. So they think that the UAE thinks that this is the way that they will be able to control this sea route. They're also building a base on the island of Perim, or Mayum, as it's called, just off the coast of Taiz in Yemen. And it's actually, this is also Yemeni territory. But it's right in the middle of the Bab al-Mandab. It's right middle of the routes of 20,000 ships that pass through the Red Sea and the Suez Canal.
The Yemeni army has in recent weeks been fighting and liberating land from the separatists in the provinces of Shabwa and Marib. The UAE is Saudi Arabia's main partner in the years-long war that Riyadh and its allies have been waging against Yemen to change the impoverished country's ruling structure. The military campaign has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and turned the entire Yemen into the scene of what the United Nations calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The onslaught enjoys American military, logistical, and political support. The UAE is one of the most advanced air defense systems in the Persian Gulf region, but they haven't been quite successful at stopping the Yemeni army's missiles and drones. The Emiratis are now looking at South Korea, Israel, and France to supply them with additional weaponry and ammunition. In its largest arms export deal in history, South Korea agreed with the UAE to sell $3.5 billion worth of Cheongung II advanced medium-range surface-to-air missiles, along with accompanying radars. Abu Dhabi is also in talks with Tel Aviv to buy its missile system, dubbed the Iron Dome. The UAE is also eyeing purchasing either Israel's Barak 8 or Spider missile systems. The systems will be installed in addition to American-made THAAD air defense batteries. And all of this comes in the backdrop of the U.S. playing a more prominent role by sending an aircraft carrier and fighter jets to the UAE. In one recent attack by the Yemeni army, the U.S. shot down the Yemeni army missiles. What does all this signal? Will this mean that the Emirates is bent on pressing ahead with its aggression against Yemen, despite the obvious losses of its mercenaries on the ground in the war-ravaged country? And the U.S., along with Israel, have promised support.
The UAE had its own goals in Yemen, which were not the same as those of Saudi Arabia. But they could only happen. The UAE could only fulfill its goals in South Yemen if there was, the Saudi Arabia succeeded in its goals in northern Yemen. That is, Yemen had to be torn apart and split between Saudi Arabian influence and UAE influence.
At any rate, the Yemeni army is vowed to continue to pound targets deep inside Saudi Arabia and the UAE until the war is over. The Yemenis are warning that the Emirates and its trade-based economy won't be able to withstand the attacks.
Meet the latest addition to Iran's diverse missile arsenal, Khaybar Shekan, a state-of-the-art missile unveiled earlier this week. It can strike its targets within a range of 1,450 kilometers with pinpoint precision. The ballistic missile is solid-fueled and therefore will be ready for launch much faster than liquid-fueled projectiles. It's even much faster and lighter than other Iranian solid-fueled models and can carry a powerful warhead. Ballistic missiles fly up into outer space before returning to hit their targets with a somehow predictable trajectory. This makes them vulnerable to interception by air defense systems.
But Iran's armed forces say Khaybar Shekan boasts high maneuverability when it dives down, making it a nightmare for any advanced missile shield. Iran has been manufacturing various types of military equipment and weapons, including missiles, despite many rounds of Western sanctions against its arms industry and other sectors. Missiles are one of the cornerstones of Iran's defense doctrine. Iran has the Middle East's most diverse arsenal of projectiles, from very short-range rockets to advanced ballistic and cruise missiles with pinpoint capabilities. Iran has been working hard to enhance them, both in terms of range and precision.
Iran is merely trying to keep up in order to defend itself. I mean, I'm sure Iran and the Islamic Revolution would like to spend that money elsewhere, but as long as you're being threatened, it is necessary to develop yourself to a degree in order to be able to have that defense. Now, you can have all the greatness that you want, but if you're not capable of defending it, you'll eventually lose it.
The Iranian pursuit of more advanced projectiles has been relentless. It makes no secret of it, because Tehran says they are a must for effective defense in the world's most dangerous region. But how did Iran master the technology to produce advanced projectiles despite decades of sanctions and import bans imposed by the West? The Iranian missile program grew out of the war initiated by the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s. Saddam's forces showered Iranian cities with missiles and bombs provided by the East and the West, while Iranians say no one sold them any proper means of defense. Iranians argue that they had no choice but building their own defense industry domestically and independently. The latest Iranian achievements are a far cry from the earliest models. Meanwhile, the West, especially the United States and its close allies, have described Iran's missile arsenal as a threat. They have tried to push Iran to abandon it, but Iranians seem to have learned to listen from the past and insist that their defensive missile power is a red line that will never be negotiated.
There has been a great deal of growing hostility towards Iran from the imperialist powers, and that in doing so, they have forced Iran to develop a greater and greater weapons with the capacity to defend themselves. They are under assault from imperialism, and this is a constant ongoing threat from the United States, Israel, and Saudi Arabia, who have formed the imperialist bloc inside of the Middle East.
When repeated Israeli threats against Iran are taken into account, the need for a robust defense program seems more urgent. Iran says its military might will enhance regional security. It also insists that it will never start a war, but if attacked, a crushing response will definitely follow.
Talks are resumed in Vienna to revive the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. This is the eighth round of such talks in the Austrian capital. The U.S. has so far failed to remove its maximum pressure sanctions, which it imposed on Iran after the former pulled out of the JCPOA, and give guarantees that a future administration will not ditch the deal again. Now Iran's top security chief said that there is no coherence coming from the U.S., on the revival of the 2015 Iran deal. Ali Shamkhani has stressed that the U.S. administration cannot impose the cost of its internal disputes on Iran.
And I think that now what we are witnessing is a division internally in the United States in the political establishment, both Democrats and Republicans, regarding a resolution to the ongoing situation with Iran, regarding whether to go back to the table and to rejoin the JCPOA. We know that Biden has made overtures, and the State Department has said that they would grant some concessions in the forms of sanctions waivers. But like many Iranian commentators and politicians and diplomats have said, it doesn't go far enough.
Voices from the U.S. government show that there is no coherence in the country to make political decisions in the direction of advancements in the Vienna talks. The U.S. administration cannot pay for its internal disputes by violating Iran's legal rights. And voice from Iran and the P4+1 group of countries, Britain, France, Russia, and China, plus Germany, have been holding negotiations in the Austrian capital for 10 months in a bid to resurrect the JCPOA.
And I think that there's not much appetite for a deal with Iran at this point. I think the Trump administration did tremendous damage to the JCPOA by removing itself from it.
The new round of talks comes amid rising hawkish voices in the U.S. A group of 33 U.S. Republican senators, led by Senator Ted Cruz, wrote a letter to President Biden warning him that any deal with Iran on restoring the JCPOA requires Senate approval. The senators warned Biden that they will do everything in their power to block a possible deal if he moves forward without them. They also said that the implementation of any agreement will be severely, if not terminally, hampered if the Biden administration does not fulfill a range of obligations in relation to congressional oversight over any agreements. The Republican senators said that if there is a deal that does not have Senate approval, it would be subject to being reversed as soon as there is a new president.
We see that the United States has been belligerent and has continued to put what it calls a maximum pressure campaign on the Iranian people, on the Iranian state, on the legal and legitimate Iranian government. And we see it as a web of coordinated activities by which we also know that Israel and the Zionist lobby are also pushing very heavily in the United States, in Washington.
The former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally left the JCPOA in May 2018 and reimposed the anti-Iran sanctions that the deal had lifted. He also placed additional sanctions on Iran under other pretexts not related to the nuclear case as part of his maximum pressure campaign. The pressure campaign was led by the Israeli and Arab lobby groups in the U.S. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden says it is willing to compensate for Trump's mistake and rejoin the deal, but it has retained the sanctions as leverage.
So I think that the internal divisions in the United States politically will continue to give free rein to the national security state in the United States to continue to put maximum pressure on Iran. But we know very well that Iran is a sovereign country and it will defend itself.
Iranian officials have repeatedly stressed that the onus falls on the U.S. to remove all illegal sanctions against the Islamic Republic in a verifiable manner and guarantee that a new U.S. administration would not breach the JCPOA again.
Neither East nor West, Islamic Republic. This famous slogan summarizes Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution and the people's fervent opposition to Cold War rivals, the United States and the Soviet Union, the two powers that then polarized the world sharply along the East-West divide. The slogan, which later became the Iranian foreign policy motto, was inspired by the ideas of Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, the late founder of the Islamic Republic, who blamed the two powers for many problems faced by Iran and the Islamic world. He believed Muslims should reject the influence of both capitalism and communism. At the onset of the Islamic Revolution, many Iranians were tired of exploitation that culminated into Iran's losing big chunks of its territory to other countries. Therefore, the revolution kindled their hopes of independence and liberty. Iran's occupation by British and Russian empires in two world wars and the country's economic exploitation, directly or indirectly, were still fresh in the collective memory of Iranians. Also etched into people's psyche was how the U.S. and Britain engrossed their democratic aspirations in 1953 by orchestrating a coup against a popular government and returning the autocratic Shah to the throne. That coup consolidated the West's imperialistic agenda over Iran for a quarter of a century. In the 1970s, the Pahlavi regime was cheered by then-U.S. President Richard Nixon as one of, quote, America's cops on the beat in the Middle East for helping steer the oil-rich region away from the Soviet influence. In those days, the Pahlavi regime even obeyed the U.S. request to support its much-criticized war in Vietnam, sending warplanes, hosting American forces, and refueling warplanes. Henry Kissinger, the U.S. Secretary of State under Nixon, admitted following the 1979 revolution that the Shah never failed to stand by the U.S. He described him as a man whom seven American presidents had lauded as a loyal ally. It was certainly a big blow for Washington to see the Shah ousted. The newly established Islamic Republic viewed both the U.S. and the Soviet Union as miscellaneous forces in international politics. The U.S. was referred to as the Great Satan, since it was the main backer of the Shah and posed the most immediate danger to the revolution. And the Soviet Union was regarded as the lesser Satan, since it was not seen as closely involved with the Iranian monarchy as the U.S. The most dramatic symbol of the revolutionary determination to assert independence was the seizure of the American embassy in Tehran in November 1979 by a number of students. Angered by the U.S. admission of Shah, they asked Washington to hand over the former despot, a request that was never met. Iran's relations with the Soviet Union and its allies were tense as well, although at a low intensity. Tehran was opposed to numerous Soviet international policies, particularly its invasion of Afghanistan. In 1988, Imam Khomeini sent a letter to then-Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev warning him of an immediate danger. That letter has gone down in history as insightful and prophetic from the leader of an independent nation to a superpower.
If you hope at this juncture to solve the economic problems of socialism and communism by appealing to the centers of the Western capitalism, you will, far from remedying any ill of your society, commit a mistake which those to come will have to erase.
The post-revolutionary Iran has now consolidated itself regionally and globally, forming warm relations with independent countries across the board. With the disintegration of the Soviet Union, Iran also pursued a look to the East policy, engaging in close collaboration with Russia and China. The independent Iran is now being regarded as a power that has contributed a lot to make the West Asian region more stable and peaceful. One such instance is Iran's role in defeating Daesh terrorism in Iraq, Syria, and beyond. Undoubtedly, Iran's Islamic Revolution was one of the biggest social upheavals of the 20th century. 43 years on, Imam Khomeini's words still resonate, and his powerful ideas of liberation from imperialistic domination, independence in domestic and foreign affairs, as well as call for embracing social justice and harmony continue to inspire not only Iranians, but people in the region and beyond.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
Basically, materialistic powers are intimidated by the word revolution. They are afraid of it, intimidated by it, and panic at the mention of the word Islamic revolution. So they have a reason for being afraid. Nonetheless, pressures are exerted with various excuses by the enemies. Sometimes they exert pressure while using the excuse of the nuclear issue. Sometimes they increase the pressure on Iran with excuse of human rights, and the like. But the truth of the matter is that the enemies of the Iranian people and of Islamic Iran are intimidated by and worried over the qualities that come with being a revolutionary. Lately, in recent months, an American politician said, sanctions are imposed on Iran because of the Islamic Revolution. The sense of sanctions originates from the revolution that was launched in 1979, the revolution of the year 1357. This is the reality.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
What is the reason, and why are they opposed to the revolution? The reason is that this great, vast, blessed and rich country that enjoys both natural and human resources of wealth was completely cut up in their claws at once. It used to be under America's control, but the revolution took over and tossed them out. Their animosity towards the Islamic Revolution is owed to this fact. The revolution sent them away. Furthermore, it inspired others around the world too. The Islamic Revolution, which was launched and pursued by the people of Iran, became an inspiration for other nations. This issue requires a detailed discussion, and there are countless reasons for that. Our revolutionary Imam Rahmatullah Alayh pulled the country out of various quagmires. He pulled the country out of various morasses with the help of the Islamic Revolution.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
In the limelight.
Accusing anyone who criticizes the Zionist regime of being anti-Semitic is a classic propaganda technique, one designed to induce guilt and to silence those calling out the regime's human rights abuses. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Mark Owen Jones, writer. This article is published under the heading Amnesty Apartheid Report: How Zionist Regime is Using Google Ads to Whitewash Its Record. Stay tuned for the details, please. The Zionist regime's foreign ministry recently created a webpage to smear Amnesty International, the UK-based human rights group that recently issued a damning report titled Israel's Apartheid Against Palestinians, a Cruel System of Domination and a Crime Against Humanity. The page, which sits on an official Israeli regime's URL and includes the foreign ministry's branding, is a repository of links to media articles that accuse Amnesty of smearing the Zionist regime. It appears to be a hastily created attempt to sway international audiences and dampen the impact of Amnesty's report. It is at the very least propaganda and at worst disinformation. Promoted via Google Ads and appearing at the top of search results when searching for Amnesty International, the page calls Amnesty a radical organization whose report ticks all the boxes of the definition of modern anti-Semitism against the regime of Israel. Accusing anyone who criticizes the Zionist regime of being anti-Semitic is a classic propaganda technique, one designed to induce guilt and to silence those calling out the Zionist regime's human rights abuses. This weaponization of anti-Semitism seeks to conflate anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. It is a tactic that has even been called out by Israel-supporting nonprofit Americans for Peace Now. Criticism is thus being portrayed as an existential threat. Such claims are clearly untrue, bordering on absurd. In its report, Amnesty simply asserted that the Zionist regime must dismantle the apartheid system and start treating Palestinians as human beings with equal rights and dignity. But the anti-Amnesty campaign doesn't stop there. Stand With Us, a nonprofit with reported links to the Zionist regime's foreign ministry, paid for a similar ad on Google, accusing Amnesty of spreading apartheid lies. Elsewhere online, users have reported that YouTube placed content warnings on Amnesty's video about the Zionist regime's apartheid. Amnesty's tech team says it has raised these issues with Google, which owns YouTube. This latest scandal highlights the role of big tech in aiding and abetting human rights abuses. Digital rights groups have repeatedly accused Facebook and other social media platforms of censoring pro-Palestinian content amid the Zionist regime's pressure. Last year, Amazon and Google employees signed a petition denouncing Project Nimbus, a $1.2 billion contract which the group of anonymous tech workers say would deliver cloud services to the Zionist regime that will help illegally collect data on the Palestinians. Tech companies are far from united in their approach to political advertising and propaganda. Google Ads has policies pertaining to political content, but these mostly concern elections. The company says it supports responsible political advertising. While this is a vague requirement, it's hard to believe that a smear campaign launched against a globally recognized human rights group by a regime that has repeatedly violated international law would fit the bill. Other platforms are equally out of sync. Twitter has banned paid political advertising, but convenient deference to local context means the company has no problem with pro-dictator political propaganda in human rights abusing authoritarian states such as Saudi Arabia. In response to MEE questions, Twitter said in a statement that since 2019, Twitter has banned political advertising on our platform. This is because we believe that political reach should be earned, not bought. And for some time now, we have encouraged a more inclusive approach to political ad regulation. In addition to our political content policy, we have also restricted and removed micro-targeting from other areas of advertising, including cause-based ads, unquote. Facebook allows political advertising, but does not allow coordinated, inauthentic behavior that seeks to manipulate public debate. although Facebook has taken down some Zionist regime's accounts as part of its efforts to combat this problem, it has been found to be far more aggressive in its modernism of pro-Palestinian and Arabic language content. Middle East Eye reached out to Facebook, but received no response at the time of publication. At some point, this goes beyond digital orientalism, the digital exploitation of non-Western markets without due concern for the consequences of that exploitation, and becomes digital imperialism, the perpetuation of structures such as U.S. foreign policy via digital technology. From a human rights or moral perspective, it should not be this complicated. If known entities such as states are engaging in disinformation and human rights whitewashing, such efforts should not be monetized by social media companies. Indeed, if platforms can agree to censor COVID-19 disinformation for the harm it poses to humanity, then they can also censor state propaganda designed to obscure crimes against humanity.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Tens of thousands of people marched nationwide while an estimated 3,000 cars converged in Paris for a freedom convoy emulating the anti-government movement in Ottawa. The convoy was led by France's Yellow Vests, who resumed their Saturday marches in October and also included some of the long-running protesters against a vaccination smart pass so strict it's been called a de facto vaccine mandate. Equally important for protesters was expressing long-running disapproval of President Emmanuel Macron and his right-wing socioeconomic policies.
The price of gas is killing us. It's all become too much for us to accept. If we keep letting things go, where is France going to end up?
France responded by flooding Paris with over 7,000 police, who waged yet another violent crackdown on peaceful protests. Dozens were arrested, hundreds of fines were issued, tear gas was constant on the famed Champs-Élysées Avenue, and cars were impounded.
I came here from Bordeaux. The government responds with violence because they have nothing else to offer. And this is why the French do not understand them. I do not think the French are stupid. They want to understand. All we want is some answers to our many questions on policy.
In order to prevent the Freedom Convoy from implanting itself, the capital was locked down in many areas, something which Paris saw every Saturday for over 6 months in late 2018 and early 2019. Freedom Convoy may have already wrested a concession. The government announced plans to abolish the pass at the end of March. Many called the timing curious, as that would be just before voters first go to the polls on April 10th. Protesters say they expect more attempts at an Ottawa-style freedom convoy, no matter how repressed by the government this one has been. It's possible the French election campaign of 2022 has just begun. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Never has it been so costly for EU citizens to heat their homes, use electricity or drive their vehicles. 40% of the 27 nation bloc's energy supply requirements are imported from Russia. So is Moscow to blame for the EU's current energy crisis? Not according to European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, speaking in the European Parliament last October.
Gazprom has honoured its long-term contracts with us.
However, last Monday it was claimed Russia has cut gas to the EU and citizens were told plans are in train to offset further suffering.
We're determined to prevent that from happening and to mitigate the impact on energy supplies and prices should Russia choose to cut natural gas supplies to Europe more than it already has.
The fact is, Russia has fulfilled all of its EU gas supply contracts. We've raised this issue with the European Commission.
Is the West using energy as a tool to ramp up tensions with Moscow?
Whether you draw conclusions with wider implications point to additional tensions of a military nature, this is your interpretation. This is not anything that we have said so far.
Political commentators claim the EU's negative Russia strategy is entirely being driven by the US.
They can't have an independent policy. It's a tragedy, I think, because Europeans should have a good relation with Russia. Russia is their neighbour. They share responsibility for the continent, for its future, for its security.
17 billion euro of EU taxpayers' money has been sent to Ukraine since 2014. This despite the European Court of Auditors declaring last September that corruption is rife in the country.
What has been done since September to try and ensure that the 17 billion euro won't be squandered?
If there are shortcomings found and proven, then we are working on removing them and making sure that what we do with Ukraine complies with our rules and with our guidelines.
On the issue of gas, of course, Russia could increase supplies to the EU, but what incentive does it have to do so in the current climate? Observers ask. Russia has the largest natural gas reserves in the world, followed by the Islamic Republic of Iran. Analysts say the EU's access to these markets is being hampered due to influence from the United States, and ultimately it is ordinary citizens who are paying the price. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The images are difficult to look at. But the reality of life for so many people in Bahrain is still one of imprisonment and uncertainty. With a few days shy of the 11-year anniversary of the uprising in Manama and surrounding districts, activists in the UK are marking the occasion. One by one, the speakers took to the podium, erected on the pavement outside the Bahraini embassy in London, with a message of defiance and resistance.
We cannot continue to be controlled and ruled by hereditary dictatorships. That time has finished. It must cease to continue. It must come to an end. That is what our people in Bahrain want to achieve, and inshallah, they will achieve that.
In the decade plus since the revolution, Manama has even managed to export some of its violence.
They are participating and helping in bombing the Yemeni children, the Yemeni women. How can this be justified by the Bahraini regime? They are also, on the other hand, have sold the lands of the Arabs and Muslims in Palestine. They have kneeled to the wishes of the Zionists, the international Zionism.
Bahrain has featured on UK parliamentary agendas, has been the subject of official inquiries with the British government, but still no progress. This as activists seek a peaceful path to lasting reforms.
It's very unfortunate that what is called international community is headed by some who are the main reason for the problems in the world, the United States and Western Europe, who are backing the dictators rather than backing the people.
Activists argue the continuing atrocities committed against the Bahraini people can only happen with the consent of the international community, and are urging fresh action, not just words.
After over a decade of broken promises, false dawns, imprisonment, intimidation, torture, and even death, the brave freedom fighters for Bahrain have pledged to fight on to get Bahrain and its people the justice they're owed. Amina Taylor, London.
The central mosque of Kashmir's capital state, Srinagar, has stood for centuries as a pedestal of religious and political activities in this Muslim-majority region. Hundreds of thousands of Muslims from different parts of Kashmir would gather here on Fridays, filling lanes and roads to say prayers in this centuries-old mosque. But now, after India abrogated Kashmir's special status in August 2019, this 600-year-old mosque remains shuttered.
This is a place of worship. Why did they impose restrictions on our religious activities when there is no lockdown for other religious activities or social and political activities? Why here? COVID is just a pretext that the government is using.
The Indian authorities see the Grand Mosque as the epicenter for anti-India protests and clashes. For decades, authorities in Kashmir have struggled to contain the sentiments in this region claimed by both India and Pakistan, but ruled in parts. The mosque, with the capacity to hold 33,000 devotees, is surrounded by a wider market that is defunct following the closure.
Fridays or occasions like Eid were the days when we would earn sustenance. For the past 2.5 years, handling family and home affairs has been tough. If authorities continue to keep this mosque closed, our families would crumble and we will be pushed into poverty.
Though the religious freedom is enshrined in the Indian constitution, people in Indian-administered Kashmir say the continued closure of Kashmir's Grand Mosque belies India's claims of religious freedom, equality and justice in Kashmir. Shahanabad, Indian-administered Kashmir.
It was a night of happy tears and regret for Iranian cineasts and filmmakers. The closing ceremony of the 40th Fajr Film Festival saw the announcement of the best films on Friday. After 10 days of a tight competition, everybody now holds their breaths as the jury announces the winners. The award for Best Leading Actress went to Tanaz Tabatabai for her performance in Without Her.
It was hard, but we nailed it. I should thank every single one of the cast and crew. If it wasn't for their efforts, I would have not been standing here.
And acclaimed Iranian actor Amin Hayai nabbed the award for Best Leading Actor for starring in The Last Snow.
This is my second Simurgh Award.
This time, too, I worked with crew members who put all their energy into the film. And this led me to win the award again.
A lineup of 22 films, mostly made by the new generation of Iranian filmmakers, competed for a Crystal Seymour as the top prize of the festival. The situation of Mehdi pocketed the awards in five categories.